Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yaki in Washington. Ahead, we speak with an analyst about the ramifications of a rift in Saudi-Iranian relations. Get details of a briefing on the fight against Islamic State. Our economics editor stops by to talk about what's frightening market investors. And we'll hear about the rise to fame of actress Ruby Rose.
That is a dream of mine. That's what I've always wanted. It's just taken me so many sidesteps to get to this position.
It's coming up right here on The Voice of America. The diplomatic crisis between Iran and Saudi Arabia intensified today, with Tehran banning all Saudi imports and accusing Riyadh of conducting deliberate airstrikes on its embassy in Yemen. Witnesses in the Yemeni capital Sana'a discount the Iranian claim. Saudi Arabia is carrying out a campaign of airstrikes in Yemen in support of forces fighting against Iranian-backed Houthi Shiite rebels. Relations in the Middle East have deteriorated this week, with several Arab nations severing diplomatic relations with Iran in solidarity with Saudi Arabia. A rift began when Saudi Arabia executed a leading Shiite cleric, Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr, and 46 other people. Angry Iranian protesters then smashed furniture and set fires at the Saudi embassy in Tehran. Demonstrators also attacked the country's consulate in Mashhad. VOA's Carol Castiel asked William Lawrence, North Africa and Middle East expert and visiting professor of international affairs at George Washington University, about the ramifications of the strain in ties.
Well, it's extremely complicated and extremely fragile right now. But I think the missing piece of the analysis, from my perspective, is that a lot of what Saudi Arabia is doing has little to do with its relationship with Iran and more to do with domestic Saudi politics and Sunni-Shia relations within Saudi Arabia, what the Saudi regime feels it can do and needs to do to stay in power, and what it's trying to accomplish on its southern border in Yemen with its fighting against the Houthis, which are a much bigger preoccupation for Saudi Arabia right now than anything going on in Syria. All of this bodes very badly for resolution of the Yemen and Syrian conflicts, but I would say that it's in these complicated moments that deals can be made. Foreign leaders won't often admit it, but there can be swaps and arrangements at times of crisis like this, and a country can give a little bit in Syria and get a little bit in Yemen. And the degree to which the great powers and the regional powers who have had such aggravating roles in Yemen and Syria can start cooperating a little bit more, focusing more on the real radicals rather than just the political opponents, where the powers need to stop fighting each other and start really focusing on the really bad guys. Both Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State have strong footholds in Yemen, strong footholds in Syria, and the degree to which, you know, either Iran or Saudi Arabia is compromised by its links to one radical group or another because of the big conflict actually bodes badly. So hopefully the Saudis and the Iranians will be forced by what's going on to come to terms at some point. And I hope that this, you know, short-term degradation of relations doesn't lead to a much more serious conflagration.
Indeed, and critics have said that the inflamed tensions between Saudi Arabia and Iran can only empower groups like the Islamic State, so that should catch their attention. But we also know, Bill Lawrence, that it's no secret that Saudi Arabia is very upset with the United States, the U.S. government. They are not happy about the Iran nuclear deal. Some critics are saying maybe this is part of their lashing out. I can't imagine that they didn't know that executing the Shiite cleric, who actually was very critical of Bashar al-Assad, whom the Iranians back, that this wouldn't upset the United States. What should the United States do now as a broker or a power vis-a-vis Saudi Arabia, the U.S. ally? What can they do to improve the situation and try to smooth over this rift?
A lot more. I think that the U.S. Doesn't have the controlling role that a lot of people think in the Middle East, nor does it have the disappearing role that certain pundits would have us believe. It still can play the quiet diplomacy and brokering role that you mentioned. The U.S. has never been in a better position vis-a-vis the Iranian regime because of the recent deal. And don't forget, we hear a lot about the hardline positions in Iran, but not about the new relationships with Iranian regime moderates that the U.S. has developed. And the U.S. has strong relationships in Saudi Arabia, notwithstanding Saudi frustration with the U.S.-Iran deal and growing regional power of Iran in a number of theaters that concern Saudi Arabia. So the U.S. can play that quiet brokering deal, and it means looking for opportunities. I think President Obama was interviewed very recently and was asked, I think it was in the Jerry Seinfeld interview, and he was asked what politics is like. Is it like poker? Is it like this? Is it like chess? And he said, no, it's like football, right, where you have this array of forces, right, against you, and you look for the opening, you know, and when you find the openings, you score politically. And this is a perfect moment where there might be an opening where the U.S. can play a brokering role between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And a lot of it's just applying bandwidth. I mean, administrations are busy, and they have a lot to do, and they have a lot of crises and bombs going off in North Korea, you know, a humanitarian crisis, and then there's probably another one around the corner. But the degree to which you can focus on deal-making in the Middle East at this critical moment will be very important for this administration, for its legacy, and for the stability of the Middle East.
You can hear more of his remarks this weekend on VOA's Press Conference USA with Carol Castiel. Let's take a look now at how the Saudi-Iranian dispute is playing out on Twitter. And my colleague Michael Lippin is here with an update. Michael, what's getting attention among Twitter users today?
Hi, Susan. One news article on the topic that Twitter is spotlighting today is by Bloomberg, whose handle is @business. We just heard from the analyst who spoke to Carol Castiel that the U.S. could play a role of mediator between the Gulf adversaries. Well, the Bloomberg piece, which is headlined, Pakistan looks to make peace between Saudi Arabia and Iran. That article talks about how the Saudi foreign minister, Adel Al-Jubeir, was scheduled to arrive in the Pakistani capital, Islamabad, for talks on Thursday. And the piece says that Pakistan wants to play the role of peacemaker in that dispute because it fears that escalating tensions between Saudi Arabia and Iran could cause further instability on Pakistani soil. That's where Pakistani forces have been trying to fight off attempts by Islamic State militants to forge a presence in their country. Another article on the topic that's drawing attention on Twitter today is by a columnist for the Wall Street Journal newspaper. His name is Yaroslav Trofimov, and his handle is @YaroTrof. He tweeted today about the situation of Arab Shiites in places like Saudi Arabia, which has a Sunni Arab majority and which executed that radical Shiite cleric last week that you mentioned earlier. In Trofimov's tweet, he writes that Arab Shiites are not Iranian proxies. He says anti-Shiite discrimination and the rise of the Sunni extremist Islamic State group pushes those Shiites into Iran's arms. And of course, he also links to his Wall Street Journal column. Susan?
Okay, well, thank you very much, Michael. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
A couple of British scientists have found that winds of over 2 kilometers per second are blowing around HD 189-733b, an exoplanet located about 63 light years away from us. According to the researchers, the exoplanet's wind speed is about 7 times the speed of sound and is 20 times greater than the fastest wind speed ever known here on Earth. The scientists use data from the High Accuracy Radial Velocity Planet Searcher, or HARPS. It's a high-resolution spectrograph device at the European Southern Observatory's La Silla telescope in Chile. The information allowed the researchers to gauge and map the planet's wind speed. They say it's the first time a weather system of a planet outside of our own solar system has been measured and mapped directly. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The United States says its coalition airstrikes have killed hundreds of Islamic State fighters in Iraq and Syria in recent weeks and reduced its oil revenue, while at the same time the IS group is losing territory. Colonel Steve Warren conducted a video conference news briefing from Baghdad.
We've continued to increase both the pace and the intensity of airstrikes in Iraq and Syria. When our airstrikes are coupled with local ground operations, we see ISIL having to react and move around the battlefield, which in turn just makes it easier for us to strike them. In December, we estimate approximately 2,500 enemy fighters were killed in coalition airstrikes across Iraq and Syria. On January 2nd, coalition aircraft struck 6 gas and oil separation points and 2 ISIL crude oil collection points near Deir ez-Zor. Since we began Operation Tidal Wave 2, the coalition has conducted 65 strikes against oil targets. We assess this operation has reduced their revenue by about 30%. We estimate that ISIL produced 45,000 barrels of oil per day before Tidal Wave 2, and it has been reduced to about 34,000 barrels per day now. So to close out, in addition to chipping away at their so-called caliphate, killing their leaders, we're also hitting them in the pocketbook.
Warren says since coalition airstrikes were first launched in September 2014, the IS group has lost between 20,000 and 22,000 square kilometers of territory in Iraq and about 2,000 square kilometers in Syria. He says Iraqi security forces continue to solidify their hold on Ramadi, which IS fighters lost last week and repelled IS attacks on Hatida. Regional analyst Stephen Zunes of the University of San Francisco says denying the IS group sources of revenue is more important than body counts.
By some measures, they have certainly lost some of the territory in Iraq and Syria that they had previously controlled. And if these body counts are to believe, they certainly lost some personnel. At the same time, as the United States and other major powers have experienced in other counterinsurgency situations, body counts really don't amount to that much. The question is, are they able to replenish their ranks? And indeed, it appears that they are still attracting recruits from various parts of the Middle East and beyond.
Well, the estimate now is between 20 and 30,000 IS members operating in both Iraq and Syria. The Pentagon spokesman on Wednesday repeated that assessment. There's a lot of work to do yet.
Certainly. At the same time, 20 to 30,000 men under arms is not that huge a figure, certainly not the profound existential threat that some right-wing politicians in the West are trying to make it sound like. At the same time, you know, the real question, I think, is where do they get their power? In addition to being able to get some recruits, they obviously need financial resources. They need a base of operations. And, of course, the big question is, will there be an ability to stop the flow of finances that help fund their operations, and whether the people who are under the control of ISIS are able to engage in a degree of non-cooperation that makes their government a shell of an actual state that they like to claim they are forming.
Well, the U.S.-led coalition said that their airstrikes against IS oil facilities have cut the militant group's oil revenues by almost one-third. How severe a setback could that represent?
That could be far more important than the number of people killed. But there's still a lot of oil flowing out of the area and a lot of revenue flowing in. More importantly, I believe, would be to try to stop the smuggling routes through Turkey and elsewhere and the corrupt officials in various countries who are making it possible.
And Stephen Zune says it remains the case that while the IS group is losing territory in many places, it continues to make advances elsewhere, making it vital that a credible fighting force on the ground in both Syria and Iraq that has popular support is necessary to both seize and hold territory. The U.S. Special Presidential Envoy to the Coalition Fighting Islamic State, Brett McKirk, warned that the sectarian divide caused by the dispute between Iran and Saudi Arabia complicates that fight by allowing extremists on both sides to take advantage of the situation and plays into the hands of groups like Islamic State. Coming up here on International Edition, what is happening to markets around the world, and we'll hear about the rise of rose. It's a scary time for stock investors with the Chinese markets once again being suspended. And the New York Stock Exchange, I was watching it on TV, in the first minutes of opening, was falling and falling and falling. Here to help us cope is VOA Senior Economics Editor Jim Randall. Hi there, Jim.
Hi.
Uh-oh. What is going on?
Well, fear. A long time ago, a president told us we had nothing but fear itself. Well, we have fear here. And the fear is that China's economy, which has been an engine of growth for the all these other countries that depend on China as a place to sell things, as a market, that China's economy is slowing down even more than we first thought. And that was reinforced when the currency, the renminbi, the yuan, the value of that was cut to the lowest it's been since, I think, August. But it was the important thing is not the absolute value of the Chinese currency, but it's the fact that the authorities pushed that value down in a bid to try to make their exports more competitive, and the investors figured that it was only being done because because Beijing figures the economy is even weaker than the rest of us thought.
But should we panic?
Panic is always a bad idea. I think we should. You should keep an eye on fundamentals. I mean, I'm not in the business of giving out financial advice, but the people who do give out financial advice say that you should not sell as stocks plunge because you're going to be selling at a loss, and then you're going to try to get back into the market eventually, and you'll be buying when the value is up. You can really hurt yourself twice by doing that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not qualified to give financial advice. I just sort of parrot it.
Okay. Well, is this going to continue for a long time, or are we going to possibly tomorrow or maybe even next week, will things start to turn around? Or,
you know, if I knew the answer to that, I would not be riding the metro to work. I would be somebody would be bringing me to work in a nice long limousine. I have no idea, and neither does anybody else.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Jim.
You're welcome.
This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
The 2016 Consumer Electronics Show, now just known as CES, took place this month in Las Vegas, Nevada, USA. This is a massive, internationally renowned four-day electronics and technology exhibition. Consumer Technology Association's Jeff Joseph says CES is introducing thousands of new technologies, products, and services that will be talked about long after the convention has closed.
Over 3,600 exhibitors, some 20,000 new technologies, products, and services, the latest, greatest, newest innovations and technologies that everyone's going to be talking about throughout the next year. Virtual reality, the latest in gaming, the latest in 4K ultra-high-definition television, auto manufacturers here from around the world, the latest in autonomous vehicles and electric vehicles. We're talking about wearables. We're talking about the Internet of Things, the latest in unmanned aerial systems, or what some people call drones. Las Vegas is the center of the technology universe.
Just go to www.cesweb.org. For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grosshans.
She's known for her role on the hit show Orange is the New Black. She's also been a VJ for MTV and is the face of denim and supply clothing from Ralph Lauren. International Edition's David Byrd tells us about Australian Ruby Rose, who has been called an androgynous Angelina Jolie.
Ruby Rose says that she would not call herself a model. That's a strange thing to say for a young woman who has been featured in Vogue Australia, In Style magazine, Marie Claire, Clio, Cosmopolitan, and Maxim. Rose is best known as Stella Carlin on the hit Netflix show Orange is the New Black. Her androgynous character has been called a badass with a permanently arched brow and a Justin Bieber haircut. Ruby, who worked as an MTV VJ in Australia, was a judge on Australia's Top Model, and is the face of Maybelline Australia, says she never sought a modeling career.
But I'm definitely not a model. I mean, I've never really been one. It's definitely like everyone always says, oh, you know, model turn actress. And I was like, but I was never a model. I wish I was, but I was always too short and boy-like and had too many tattoos. But I think the acting is it's really what's taking up all my time, and that is a dream of mine. That's what I've always wanted. It's just taken me so many side steps to get to this position.
For the recent Ralph Lauren campaign, Rose teamed with model and friend Hailey Baldwin. The 29-year-old Australian says that the shoot was more organic, with photographer Mark Seliger working in a warehouse in Brooklyn.
It's very collaborative, so we kind of put our heads together and thought about what was authentic and real for me. And I have, like, a real love for street art and music and all things artistic. So we kind of put together a day in the life of, although it went for sort of 2 days, and just filmed what we would do naturally.
Ruby says that her androgynous style reflects how she feels comfortable, and she doesn't want to change her look just to please those around her.
I think that whether it's just timing, whether it's just really being true to myself and staying true to myself and not taking what people say to heart or being even really affected by it whatsoever is a really strong point of mine. So I haven't really felt that it's been difficult to stay true to myself.
Rose, who came out as a lesbian at age 12, says her role on Orange is the New Black has helped start a much-needed dialogue about gender role and identity, both in the entertainment industry and worldwide.
People were waiting to start this conversation. They just wanted somebody to start it. Someone had to ignite it, and then once that happened, it was just like a snowball effect where, you know, you had celebrities and all different people coming out and saying, I'm gender fluid, or, you know, I'm transgender, or people feeling more comfortable in their skin to be able to really just express that.
Though it's not definite that her character will be back on Orange is the New Black, Ruby Rose has two films on her schedule, John Wick 2 with Keanu Reeves, and Resident Evil, The Final Chapter. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. That's voanews.com. If you look at that page, up in the upper right-hand corner is a thing called the Programs tab. And if you scroll down there, you'll find International Edition. You can listen to this program, or you can use a little calendar to go to yesterday or months ago. So if there was something a while ago you want to rehear, feel free to scroll around. Okay, want to thank you for joining us.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The U.S. Department of State's Rewards for Justice program is offering rewards for information leading to six key leaders of the Somalia-based terrorist organization Al-Shabaab. The U.S. Secretary of State has authorized rewards of up to $6 million for information on the whereabouts of Abu Abeda Diriyah, up to $5 million each for information on Mahad Karate, Ma'alim Daoud, and Hassan Afguye, and up to $3 million each for information on Ma'alim Salman and Ahmed Imam Ali. Since 2006, Al-Shabaab has killed thousands of civilians, aid workers, and peacekeepers in Somalia, Uganda, and Kenya. Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for the July 11, 2010 suicide bombings in Kampala, Uganda, which killed more than 70 people, including one American citizen. Al-Shabaab also claimed responsibility for the September 21st through 24th, 2013 terrorist attack against the Westgate Shopping Mall in Nairobi, which left more than 60 people dead and nearly 200 wounded, and the April 2, 2015 attack on Garissa University College in Kenya, which resulted in 150 deaths. The U.S. Secretary of State designated Al-Shabaab a foreign terrorist organization on March 18, 2008. In February 2012, Al-Shabaab and the Al-Qaeda terrorist network jointly announced they had formed an alliance. Abu Abeda, also known as Diriyah, was named the leader of Al-Shabaab on September 6, 2014, after the death of former Al-Shabaab Emir Ahmed Abdi Al-Mohammed, otherwise known as Godanye. Mahad Karate, also known as Abdirrahman Mohammed Warsameh, has played a key role in Al-Shabaab's assassination operations in the April 2nd attack on Garissa University College. Ma'alim Daoud is responsible for Al-Shabaab's planning, recruitment, training, and operations against the government of Somalia and Western targets. Hassan Afguye oversees Al-Shabaab's financial activities, ranging from fake charities and fundraising to racketeering and kidnapping. Ma'alim Salman leads Al-Shabaab's African foreign terrorist fighters and has been involved in attacks against tourists, entertainment establishments, and churches in Africa. Ahmed Imam Ali has recruited Kenyan youth and raised funds for Al-Shabaab. Anyone with information on these terrorist leaders should contact the nearest U.S. embassy or the Rewards for Justice office via the website at www.rewardsforjustice.net or by email at info@rewardsforjustice.net. Individuals in North America can call this phone number, 1-800-877-3927.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.